This is Richard Barone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. David Hammond. Today is May 15th, 2006, and it's approximately 10:15 a.m. Central Standard Time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Dave is again in Beaverton, Oregon. Dave, let's pick up where we were last time. After this really bad night and being turned down to transfer back to the rear and being sent back out, all these replacements coming in, I did want to ask you two things. One, about what time is this month-wise in your tour?
Month-wise, when we hit that mine, I believe it was July 28th. I'd only been in country since about the, I think I got actually in country to our company about the second week of June. So this would all be within the first couple of days of August as far as after I had gone back with another fellow. Thought about saving my life and getting out of the field, but that didn't work. So I was back out in it with the unit. Well, same day. So that was the 1st of August.
Okay. How was it getting the replacements in over the next days?
Very strange. In fact, we were all still in kind of some kind of a shock and so down as a unit because we'd lost so many people. That we dreaded, usually when new people would come in, and I was actually still new because I was only been there about 6 weeks, but usually when new people came in, we would get one, two, usually never three at a time. They would dribble in as people would leave the company. And this time we had an influx of probably 20 that came out, and they kind of spread out amongst the two platoons that we had. So as we sat on the one fire support base, I guess you'd call it, the helicopters were coming in and dropping the new guys off. And it was just not that I didn't like any of them. I think most of us felt we just didn't want to have to deal with trying to show anybody what to do again. And it took a little while to get to know them all. And pretty soon they all blended in, and I see a lot of them now that came out there as replacements. I see them yearly at our reunions.
Mm-hmm. And do you still see them at the reunions as kind of the new guys, the replacements?
No, not so much anymore.
Okay.
It didn't take them very long. But the one thing they don't have, there's just a few of us that went through that one experience that are still around as far as losing all our people and spending the night out there in that hill is why they ended up in the new guys ended up in our company anyway. Mm-hmm. So they don't have that in common, but they've got the whole rest of the tour in common with us.
Right. Let me ask you just a couple of general questions about being out in the field. What about friendly fire? How often was that part of your tour?
We had, I only can remember one instance when it happened to us, and we were on a daytime patrol, and I think we were on there had been a big push, some kind of battle one of the other brigades had been in, I think, and we were combat assaulted or helicoptered in to an area to sweep over an area to see if there was, because they'd hit it with artillery and everything else, and see if we could find any bodies or any sign of the enemy. And I can remember it would be a fairly heavy canopied jungle area, and we could hear these gunships working out with their machine guns and things, and they would get closer and closer and closer, and pretty soon they were right on line coming right to us. And I can remember, I wasn't turning the radio right then, but the lieutenant and the RTO were on the radio and got a hold of somebody in a panic fast enough that they probably missed us by 100 yards, but that's pretty – 100 yards isn't very much, I think, as far as a helicopter goes when you're looking up.
Sure.
We never lost anybody. We had one real bad incident that not many people talk about, and it's nothing that we shouldn't, but a few of us do, but we had a couple of the new guys that came out to the company, everyone was set up on ambushes, and I was on the next ambush over from where they were. Well, before they went out, everybody was going to go outside the wire, and that's where you would go as far as to relieve yourself. And before we were going to go on these ambushes, but what happened is a Vietnamese interpreter, along with this other fellow, his name was Jerry, I think it was Frilling, was his last name, went across the wire and did their thing, and somebody, because it was getting dusk, was to walk back in, and one of the fellows, the new guys, you know, said, "Who goes there?" And the Vietnamese interpreter, which was with us all the time, mm-hmm. said something smart or smart alecky or whatever. Well, it panicked the new guy, and he opened up on him, and he killed Jerry Frilling, which was one of his own squad members. So even to make it worse than that, once that happened, that was terrible. But the monsoons were setting in, and we had Jerry's body lay under a poncho, I think, for almost 3 days out there with us. We couldn't get helicopters out to pick him up, pick the body up. Well, in the meantime, the poor fellow that shot him, you know, was there, and it was a real bad situation. I think once we got the helicopter in there to take the body away and ship the other fellow off that had accidentally killed him, I know he ended up, I think, at one of the hospitals. I think he pretty much was traumatized the rest of his life over that, but you can call that friendly fire,
right? Yeah.
So that's, you know, that was, I wasn't standing right there when it happened, but I was there when we were trying to figure out how to get the body out of there. But that was the two instances that I can remember, and then the one was the bad one, losing one of the fellas.
How did this individual deal with killing one of the squad
members? It was bad. I can remember, too, after we finally got all back to the rear for a couple of days, everybody was pretty much drowning their sorrow as usual over at the PM club, and I don't know what the fella said. He was kind of keeping to himself, but one of the other guys kind of, they had a few words, and one of the fellas punched him a few times, and it was such a frustrating thing to lose someone. But I pretty much think I know he probably needed mental health, you know, right after that, and probably the rest of his life he's been traumatized by it. So it was, something you wouldn't know unless you were in his shoes, I guess, but it had to be terrible.
Has he come to the reunions?
No, we've never seen him again. Once they shipped him off, he never came back to the field with us. He was gone right after that. I think they just knew he just wasn't going to deal with it anymore. But no, we've never heard hide and hair from him, and I don't think we ever would anyway. Hmm.
Do you think that you or others still hold some kind of a grudge or problem with that? I mean, obviously that's still a bad incident.
Oh, but it's terrible. Yeah. I don't think so much as I know some of the fellows that were in the squad with the two of them, because Jerry, the fellow that we lost, had been around a while. The new guy had only been there for, I don't know what it was, maybe a couple of weeks. I think the squad members, their immediate squad members, probably had some real problem with it. I didn't personally know them real, real well, just because you're kind of, you're tightest with the four or five guys in your squad that you're always with. So,
mm-hmm.
But we did have three of, the year before last, there were three of our group that always go to the reunions. They did go to see this Jerry Frilling's mother, and they went to visit her and took her some pictures that we all had of him that she'd never seen before. And come to find out, she'd never ever gotten the whole story of what had happened. They kind of thought they knew what had happened, but from what the fellas told me, that his mom was in her 80s, I think, when they saw her, and his sister was there. It was pretty emotional, but, you know, they were able to, I think they told her pretty much what had happened. They wanted to know, and they had a pretty good idea. So that put a little bit of closure, I think, on it for some of our group, you know, and I think it probably helped their families some. But there's been some instances, I think, when we've tried to contact other people that we've lost, and the parents don't want to hear about it, so mm-hmm. we just let it go. And this one, they did want to hear about it, so I think this worked out better for all.
Right. How do you all deal with death in general? I mean, this is almost hanging over your head every day, but as you move forward in your tour after these pretty traumatic things early on, how do you deal with that?
I don't remember ever being, I think everybody dealt with it different. I don't ever remember being overly afraid all the time. Like I said in one of our earlier conversations, that if I would have been so afraid about dying, I would have, you know, would have been digging the deepest foxholes every time we stopped for the night and all of that. And I don't think I did. And I wasn't too lackadaisical about it. I was careful. But I just think it maybe was happening around you so much that, not that dying was an everyday thing, but I think that was the more the being losing a foot or a leg or a limb, I think that probably worried me more, but I don't think I was too much worried about the dying part.
And I remember you saying that you just wanted to survive,
but
you had convinced yourself that you were going to die probably.
Did I sense
it? Did you sense that, you know, listen, this has happened so early on, there's no way I'm going to survive this entire tour?
Early on, when the first night I was out there in the field, and I counted up, I had 300 and whatever odd days to go. I thought there's absolutely no way you can live through something like this. And then after we'd lost so many people so fast, and we'd pretty much lost people to, not necessarily death, but to mines and booby traps and things, you know, on a weekly basis, you just thought there's absolutely no way that you're going to survive this thing. So basically what everybody did was do your best to make it every day and don't take any unnecessary chances. And luckily, most of the lieutenants we had were pretty much in the same boat. You know, they were 23, 24 years old. You know, they were much older than the rest of us. So we were all very careful. And a lot of us, you created ways to get out of the field, which is also, you know, going to mean you're going to make it through your tour. And like I said earlier, most of the guys created a way or created a job to get rotated back into the rear to do something else. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. Okay. When you went to, you just mentioned this, to dig in a foxhole, mm-hmm. Setting up a perimeter, digging in, I know you all were taught a standard way to do that, but how close did you stick to something like this, this very kind of mundane daily or every other day thing?
Yeah, well, mine was a little different. I was taught, I had to be taught by the people that were there in the field because, like I said before, I was trained on tanks. I never had any idea. If I would have gone to infantry school, I would have known at least a little bit about what an infantry platoon and squad does, and I didn't have a clue. But as far as the going by what I was told, it was pretty much a routine thing, but the routine was basically at night, if you were on an ambush, you set up claymore mines, and if you weren't and you were on a fire support base, everybody got their fields of fire established, and or you're going to dig a foxhole, and we set out trip flares or claymore mines, and it was pretty much the same old thing night after night, either if you were either on an ambush or on a night defensive perimeter. Pretty much the same stuff, and you pretty much just look forward to daylight. And then once it got to be daylight and sun came out, and you'd made it again through another night, and things got better in the daytime.
Tell me about that, the difference between the nighttime and the daytime. You know, that's something that a lot of people talk about in Vietnam, that, you know, quote-unquote, Charlie ruled the night, and you guys ruled the day. What about that?
Yeah, I don't know if we ever really ruled the day. I think they probably pretty much had us all figured out. But
why do you say that?
Well, because we were probably the noisiest army ever was. You know, the people that the Viet Cong that we would come up against, I would think there was the few times we actually got to see them, there were no more than two or three or four of them, you know, at one time. And like I said before, they might only have one weapon, two weapons. They didn't have a lot as far as an area as I was at. But I would think that they would know any time we were going one way or another. I think they were probably way ahead of it. And the few ambushes that we actually, you know, got somebody in, I think it was just a fluke. I think of most of the time, even through the villages that we would go through, you know darn well that after we got through them, there was probably most of them were VC anyhow, and they would know how many there were, which way we were going, and what we were up to. And they could also watch the helicopters. They could watch the helicopters bringing in resupply, and I think they're pretty smart about it. I think they knew a lot. But as far as ruling the night, think they were on the move. They did a lot of their stuff at night. And in the daytime, they knew pretty much to lay low because that's, you know, we'd be out wandering around all day. So.
Right. What about the firepower of the United States could bring to bear?
Yeah, that was something to see. That was a spectacular thing to watch. Anyway, first time I got to see a napalm dropped, it was almost like watching the 4th of July, you know, major fireworks. I'd never seen anything like that.
Can you describe that? What did it look like?
Pretty much, if you've ever watched any of the movies, Apocalypse Now and Platoon, those are two big ones. You would hear the jets, you know, screaming in, and pretty soon you'd hear a huge flash, and then just kind of like a rolling cloud, and then the big thunderclap, and pretty much just wipe out everything for, I don't know how far that stuff had spread, because we were always way away from it when it was going on. But I don't think cover up a mile or whatever it would do, but it was something that there would be nothing living in its path when they would come in. The other ones that I was amazed at was all of the Cobra gunships that would come through there and shoot their rockets and their machine guns and things. And then I forgot the name of the one that would shoot around every inch and cover a football field in a matter of seconds.
C-130?
Yeah. And I saw one of those a couple of times. They just kind of like make a real loud belching sound and just annihilate everything in just a matter of seconds. So I just can't believe how much money we spent doing that. My God. And I'm sure it had, it must not have had a whole lot of effect because they kept coming. So
right.
We had all kinds of firepower, but we still lost a ton of people. You know, and that's one of those wars that I think thought we should have had the thing handled right away, but I don't think firepower had a whole lot to do with it.
Yeah. Okay. Did you all ever work with canine units?
The only, yes, we did. In fact, a couple of times there was some canine, I remember, the one was we had a mine dog come out just to, try to get us off the one hill we talked about. But I've got some pictures, and I don't remember it real specifically, but I got some pictures of the guys in our squad standing with the German Shepherd. Not quite sure where we were. And then also that good friend of mine that you know, Steve Dant, he was wounded when a dog handler and a dog tripped a booby trap.
Right.
So he was. Yeah, I wasn't around. I wasn't there when that happened to him right before I got there.
But, I remember that.
Yeah. So I don't remember specifically much about having any dogs around.
Okay. What about snipers?
A lot of snipers. But ours, I don't think ours were usually one-shot snipers. I call them snipers even if they would empty a magazine, you know, in your direction. And that's probably the most, I was never in one of those, what we'd think these grandiose firefights that would, you think, last for hours or days or things that had happened to some people. But most of the time we would get, a half a dozen rounds sniped at us, and then I think they would take off on a dead run. But never, I would not think they would be a sniper like we would think our snipers. Our snipers, you know, would be in three-man or four-man teams and one-shot type of guys. I didn't run into any of that on their side.
Okay. Could you tell me about your experiences with the Dust Bowl teams and their effectiveness and what you saw?
Yeah, they were good. Most of the time, they got there very, very fast. Of course, the dust off that we couldn't get the one fellow that was killed by one of our own by accident because of the monsoons, they couldn't get there. But the dust off, we had one incident when we lost a fellow to a mine that we were trying to help that they had to back off because they were taking fire coming in. And I don't remember a lot of specifics about them. I just remember things were fast. It seemed that, I guess our area, I don't know how many miles it would have been from where the base was, but it seems like whenever we would need anything like that, and especially a dust off, it was only a matter of a couple of minutes till you could hear the helicopter on its way as far as the rotor slapping the wind, and it was on its way. And they got there fairly fast, and I think it was you know, that probably saved a lot of lives. You know, they were so quick.
Did you ever hear about or witness anything to do with fracking?
No. I know it no doubt happened, but I think I'd gone over a little of this before, but it was happening so much in the rear that they took all our weapons from us, and a lot of it when we would come back to the rear, because it was fairly secure there. So all of the line units or the field units that would come back in, they don't think they quite padded it down, but it was close. So they took every weapon and every hand grenade, everything that we had, they took from you before you came back in to your company area. And it was all locked up in an armorer's building. And I think that had to do some with fragging, some with the racial tension that we had.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I was never involved in your, not that I never saw any.
Right. I wonder if you could make some comments about basically your equipment, but more specifically the weapons that you carried. What was your favorite? How did they function? And basically, what did you carry with you?
Well, when I first got there, it's an M16. I'd only actually trained just a little while with one, had maybe one class with it, because I was, I was not trained to be an infantryman, but I kept it fairly clean. The thing I liked most about that, it was light, very light. The other weapon that we passed around amongst each squad was an M60 machine gun. And I don't know why, but we always used to plague the new guy with carrying it just because it weighed so much. And once in a while, somebody wanted to volunteer to do it. But there was a lot of weight to carrying that, the 60 machine gun, because when you carried that and a couple of full bandoleros of ammunition over your shoulders, there was a lot of extra weight that you had. I never carried one. I got to shoot one. We had the M79 grenade launcher, which we called a bloop gun because of the noise it made when it shot. It made a bloop. So it shot little grenades. A couple of the fellows were really good with those, and they wore a vest. It would be like a hunting vest if you're hunting pheasants or quail, and had all of the rounds in there. They would have shotgun type shell rounds as far as bird shot, you'd think of them, and also little grenades. Once towards the end of my tour, the few of the companies I'd seen them, I didn't remember us having them. They just came out with the over and under. So it was basically an M16 with an M79 grenade launcher all in the same weapon. And I think they have those as of today.
Yes, they do.
But that was something brand new that we saw, because the old bloop guns that our guys carried were a wood stock. They just looked like somebody's old sawed-off shotgun. So that would be their weapons that we had. Then we did have a mortar squad that they attached to us that would travel with us, and they would carry a mortar tube and a plate. And I don't know how many rounds they had, but that was some heavy stuff for them to be packing.
So you carried the M16. Did you have a 45?
No, I never carried a 45. Carried the 16, did the 60 for a while, but mainly the M16, because then after I did that, I volunteered to carry the radio. And to me, carrying a radio was kind of a good and bad. To me, it was being as close to the lieutenant as you could be. You'd know what was going to go on all the time, because he was in charge of the platoon. But on the other hand, like I mentioned before, you were one of the primary targets if somebody was trying to get to the lieutenant or to the radio man. So, but it was another, I think it weighed, 20, 25 pounds maybe. It was heavy. It wouldn't count the batteries with it. So whoever carried the radio carried an M16. That's what you carried. I don't remember anybody that we had had a 45 pistol at all. I don't remember those. Now, but again, I was trained with those because tankers carry those, but I didn't see anybody had one of those in our unit.
What was the most feared weapon?
From them, well, for us, because we didn't really come up against, we would come up against the NVA once in a while, but no big, massive battles. It was mainly the VC, so whenever we'd run into something, the most feared for us, it was the, I would say it was the toe poppers. You know, we had like when we lost all our people, that was a daisy chain setup that wiped us out. But the toe popper is what everybody feared, because we hit them on a regular basis. And I don't remember a toe popper, which is basically what it means. It blows one foot off or both your feet off. It never killed anybody that I can remember that hit them. But it was such a demoralizing loss every time that would happen. It was a traumatic thing. I know dying is too, but when you continually see people losing a foot or two, it starts taking a toll, and then you're just very, very leery of every move you make. That's why we were so careful, I guess, when we would walk and be on patrols. And that's what was so bad in the evenings when we would go out on ambushes. We'd try to go out at dusk. You couldn't see anything. So whether you were going to step on one or not, you never know. But to our group, I would have to say that they were hitting the toe poppers and any kind of booby trap that they had set for us. That's mainly what we ran against.
Right. You know, I've heard that from other veterans, that the booby traps were the most feared thing.
Oh, yeah.
Because of the randomness.
Yeah, and there was just so many of them.
Yeah,
it was just something you couldn't tell. And then, even today, I know I inquired about it. My oldest son has bought me a trip to Vietnam, which I was supposed to have gone on a while back, but I've just not gotten to it, but I'm still going to go. But when I first had inquired to go back to this area that I would like to be, but to go back to see, I don't think we can't get in there. From what I was told, a lot of these areas they have so many mines and booby traps are still there, because most of the fellows setting the mines, the VC, they were probably killed right afterwards. So nobody knows where this stuff is.
Well, as far as the enemy and as far as weapons, and then you moving to the radio and kind of being a target, an easier target or more, prolific target on their part. Tell me about the intelligence you all had about the enemy, and then about communication within your ranks and the rear, and what you experienced there on the radio.
Well, the radio, to me, I was just kept abreast of everything. Most of my contact would be when I wasn't on an ambush and I was back in the night defensive perimeter. We would call a sitrep or be a situation report, so that every ambush site would have a radio, and we would key the microphone, and communication was supposed to be done hourly, and that would be a confirmation that everything was okay. A situation report would go as a sitrep, and you would key the mic, I think, a couple of times back and forth. And so no one wanted to, you couldn't talk. They had to be so quiet. So every now and then, and I mentioned before too, that every now and then you couldn't get a hold of one of the ambush sites. You hadn't heard anything happen as far as the gunshots or explosions or anything, and then sure enough, somebody's fallen down asleep, but luckily nothing ever happened to them while I was with doing that. The other communication would come when usually the lieutenant was on the radio as far as any kind of coordinates that were given. He was the one, or the forward artillery observer that we would have with us. He had an RTO also with him, and they would get the coordinates. So I think mine was just, I just enjoyed kind of being in the middle of it as far as communication amongst everybody. And yeah, it's a little bit more of a senior position, and so it's something that I think you'd work yourself, people work themselves up to carry the radio, or I did.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever work with the Arvins?
Worked with the Arvins quite a lot. Worked with the RFs and the PFs, which would be the popular forces and regular forces. They would be like our National Guard and Army Reserve. We did a lot with them outside the villages. Arvins, we didn't get along with too well. I'm not quite sure why. I didn't have a lot to do with them, but they seemed a little bit cocky and arrogant. I think we're kind of being out of shape, because I don't think from the ones that we saw, we felt we were doing everything anyway as far as the battles and the patrols and the trying to take care of the Viet Cong and the NVA, and I think they've come to rely on the Americans so much that they really were a little lackadaisical about everything. And that would be the same for the RFs and the PFs that we worked with. And to them, it was they're so used to, I think a lot of it was they were so used to war after the French that, again, we had some instances when come 1 o'clock at night or whatever it might be, they'd start lighting their little cooking fire and stuff. It really didn't matter. And if I think back on it, they probably knew who was where, and a lot of them were probably working both sides anyhow. So if they had been really afraid about us being attacked by the Viet Cong or the NVA, they wouldn't have been cooking and jabbering and doing their thing in the middle of the night. So they were okay. But we didn't rely on them as far as any kind of support.
Did you all have, I guess that answers that. You didn't have very much confidence in their fighting ability or their ability to stick with you and protect your flanks or rear.
Oh, no. We never got into that. We did a lot of patrols with them, but we never had any confidence in them. The people that I think that we did get closest to were the interpreters we had. We had a couple of kids, we called one Peanut, and we called the other one Sammy. And these little—they were—I believe—they were probably orphan kids, but they were interpreters for us. They could speak enough English that we kind of adopted them, and they would go out with us patrol. You know, they would carry a rucksack once in a while. They might even have a rifle, but we adopted them, and they would be the interpreters if we would happen to come upon some villagers and things. And then we were also assigned, on a regular basis, like a Kit Carson scout, which would have been a Chiu Hoy, they would come over to our side and then act as a guide or a scout for us. And a couple of those I think were okay. Some of them we were real leery of. We thought maybe they were still working the other side. But when we lost all the people in the one big mine, we lost one of the kids. I think it was Peanut. He got killed in that. And also our Kit Carson scout that we had there, he died in that explosion too. So they were very useful to us. Sad thing is, I think the ones that we got to know that worked with most of the companies, I would imagine that once we pulled out, as far as the war goes, they were probably... It probably ended their life right then once the North Vietnamese got in and figured out who was a real collaborator for us.
Right. Did you ever work with the leaders, the officers of ARVN, or any of the other Vietnamese military forces?
No, I never did. No.
Okay. Well, switching gears, mm-hmm. to more personal questions, were there religious services in the field? I know you mentioned the chaplain coming out through that hill that night, but were you all able to attend a quote-unquote church service out in the field or in the rear?
In the rear, the one time that I mentioned that when they came out, that was just because of our losses, but there, as I recall, every time we came in for a stand down, there was a service in the rear there. And it didn't matter what day it was because we were just in there at different times. So, yeah, if someone, felt or needed to go or was religious that way, there was always that opportunity. They could partake.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What about you? Did your spiritual feelings
I never have been. It's one of the, I still, in my family, no secret to my family, I still struggle with knowing if there really is, I guess, really is a God or really isn't. There's just so many unanswered questions. And I've actually approached, I'm a Catholic, and actually approached a priest and try to get answers out of people on why so many things, bad things can happen. And, mm-hmm. Yeah, and I have a real problem with some of the answers everybody gives. And to see the certain things that go on in the world and that I saw, which are fairly tame to some of the horrific things that have happened in other parts of the world, I really have questions. And to me, it never made me feel any better. I mean, you can go in there to church service and do whatever you want. The next day, we're out in the field and somebody gets his feet blown off. So I just didn't have a lot of faith.
Okay. How about the guys in your unit? What did you see?
As far as
religion, spiritual preferences?
Some of them. Yeah, there was a few of them. In fact, that good friend of mine, Jesse Hill, I mean, he still is. He had the face over there, and he was also wounded very bad in the big mine, and spent months and months in over in Japan in the hospital. But he had it then and has it now, and it was a real mixed bag, and I think it was because of the draft, you got a real mixed bunch of fellas in there as far as all kinds of backgrounds. And, a lot of people, I think, wore those rosary things around their neck. That was more of a fashion statement. So, but, yeah, there were some religious, some not, and some of them that I didn't think were so religious seem to be now. There's some of them that we get together with that I know weren't that way. Are very religious that I skip to reunions now, which is fine, and they're doing fine. I think they needed that. It makes them feel better, so more power to them.
Was that a function of their war experience, do you think?
I think it had something to do with it. One of my good friends, I think he came back, got into a motorcycle gang, had all kinds of troubles in his earlier life, and I think a lot of it had to do with Vietnam. And I think he's one of those that he'd gone so far one way as far as the wrong way with his, probably the drinking and the drugs and the motorcycle gang and all of this, that all of a sudden he's what you'd be calling born again, or maybe born for the first time, a Christian fellow. Mm-hmm. But just a great, great guy, and got a great wife. And, you know, I correspond with him all the time and see him yearly. And, you know, our group is, like most people now. I think back then nobody hugged, but you know, all we do is hug each other anymore. I mean, nobody's real too worried about that. We just, a lot of hugging.
Why?
I don't know. It feels good. Handshake is fine if you just kind of know somebody a little bit, but what we've been through, it just seems appropriate. I mean, it just hugs all the way around. And a lot of us, I would think that we probably wouldn't even be friends or like each other, but we have such a common past that, you know, we're very, very, very close. One of the early, I don't know if I'd ever mentioned this, but one of the first reunions that I'd gone to, once the thing was, I think it was five of us that showed up, had never seen each other. This is the first time we'd ever seen each other, and we said no wives. At all, because we didn't know how we were going to act. Mm-hmm. It was too strange. It had been so many years, and we had a great time, but what I was thinking of the hugging was, is that when it came time for the reunion to be over, this would have been in 96, I think there was one guy to leave a little bit, but the four of us, we stood in the airport and just bawled like babies for 15 minutes. It was very emotional. I think there'd been a lot of emotion held in for so many years that they just came pouring, and they still do. We still all get pretty much teary-eyed around each other. So.
Yeah, so that stayed pretty consistent.
Yeah, just a special bunch, and it's just nice to know that you've got some people you've got something in common with. I threw a story on the survivor's guilt that I had published a while back that mentioned how some people would try to ask you about the war because they thought it was the right thing to do, but you didn't feel like telling them about it because they couldn't understand or comprehend or anything. They didn't have any idea what you were talking about, so you didn't say anything. Unlike if you were to talk to a fellow veteran that had been there, you could ramble on for however long you needed to because he'd understood what you were talking about. And, a little different subject, but also you can tell who the fakers are and who aren't, because after about 30 seconds of listening to somebody talk, you know if they were really there or if they're just a wannabe, and that happens every night.
How can you tell?
Well, most of it is I had one happen to me not long ago. A fellow saw my license plate and said, oh yeah, he was here and here. And anytime somebody starts bragging up things that they did or things they saw, you have to question it anyway, because the guys that really saw it, they don't talk much about it. You know, somebody will ask you how it was and did you see much action, and most people just say, yeah, you know, enough, or it wasn't any fun, and you just leave it at that. But he went on and on and about things and places he'd been, and I forgot how it came about, but later on in the conversation, I said, well, you know, where'd you grow up, or high school? Well, come to find out, he would have had to have been 15 years old, you know, to be there.
Wow.
So there was another, you know, there was just one instance. I had another fellow stop me down here in the street in Portland one time. I don't know why, because I didn't have on a veteran hat or anything, but asked me if, you know, I was a vet, and we talked for a couple minutes, but he mentioned a couple of places that he'd been, and I could tell it. He'd just heard people talk about it. So there's a book I know that came out, and a friend of mine, Steve Dant, has an old sitting on his desk, and I forgot what the name of it is, but it goes over all these imposters that are out there, and a lot of them have gotten huge military benefits from that.
It's called Stolen Valor.
That's what it is, yeah. Steve has that, and I'm going to get it the next time I see him, but it's just easy to tell. You can, by what they want to share with you, by not even knowing you, and some of the things they say, it's real easy to see through people.
I want to talk about the relationship you all had there in Vietnam within the unit, and what you said about your post-Vietnam years. I've witnessed so much and heard about so much within the unit, and then also back in the rear. Can you talk about, say, race relations and race issues? You've already mentioned this a bit, but I wonder if you could kind of go into that and what you saw and your feelings about it then and now.
Yeah, it was sad. I had one good friend of mine at the time. In fact, we came in about the same time. His name is James Rose, or it is James Rose. He's been emailed a couple times. We've never gotten together, but a black fella. And what was different about James is that he also didn't really have any kind of a racial problem. You know, at the time, he was could go either way, but he did hang out with some guys who seemed to not like the white folks much at all, you know, and so I kind of kept my distance there. Not afraid, it just wasn't uncomfortable. I mean, you can tell somebody doesn't want to be around or like it or not. But on the other hand, my good friend Jesse Hill, we're best friends. We did everything together, including we see each other now at some of the reunions that he comes to. But overall, they kept to themselves. The white guys kept to themselves. I personally never ever had a, besides the one big barroom brawl that we were all in, I never had a problem or ever was, I guess, either attacked or had a problem with any of them. I don't think I carried myself that way. Some of the southern guys that had as much chip on their shoulder as the black guys did have chip on their shoulder, they always seem to have problems. But they probably would have problems if they're back in the States anyway.
Right. Did anyone try to quell that or inflame it?
I don't think so. I there wasn't really any way to stop it. Things were out of hand back in the States. The war was going the wrong way. You know, they claimed it was, you know, the white man's war, and then they claimed the percentage of blacks and whites were not right as far as here, but I never really saw that. I always thought it, you know, we had, you know, some black fellas with us, but overall it was mostly middle class white. But growing up where I did, I just never was exposed to it. I don't know. It was a real bad thing because it shouldn't have been that way. But it is, and it probably still is to some degree today.
Did you ever witness any homosexual activity?
No, I can't. The only time I ever saw anything, and it wasn't and this would have been actually in basic training, I think we had a gay guy that got drafted, and I think he'd been picked on enough in there that he'd only been in there maybe with us about 2-3 weeks, and pretty soon that he was gone. I think they probably just discharged him and sent him out. But as far as anybody gay, I never saw anything like that. Now, that was kind of the last thing on your mind.
Okay.
I mean, when you're in the middle of a war, I don't know if I was, maybe somebody was, but nobody was, didn't stand out.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you all keep any pets?
We had one fella when he got in the rear, had a monkey. didn't see the monkey very much. We couldn't really have any pets because we were out in the field all the time, and you couldn't really have a dog or anything. Once in a while, I'd see somebody have a scroungy dog, you know, that they had, but they were people that had already been back in the rear. But no, when you're on the move, we couldn't haul any pets with us.
Right. What about wild animals? What did you run into?
Mostly monkeys in the trees were always bad because from making noise all night. And the wild boar here or there, you'd see. And one of them, I think, hit a claymore mine once. And snakes, but none of the scary. You know, they tell you all these horror stories, like the two-step snake of things. You know, the first step, you bite you, and the second step, you're dead. And I think those are wives' tales. I never saw one. Big thing we had, leeches were probably the worst. And that's not really wildlife or anything, but that's one of the worst things that we had were leeches.
Was that a daily occurrence?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, depending on the area how bad they were, but leeches were all over. Mosquitoes, you know, were bad. Flies. But, you know, we had everybody carried the bottle of bug juice with them, and it was pretty much miserable, but it was miserable anyway as far as hot and sweaty and dirty and squirting bug juice on yourself. But you dealt with it.
Was that a problem, being hot and dirty all the time?
You got used to it, but I can't believe now that we would go a couple of weeks sometimes without a shower or anything. Because when you're out there, and I got there in the dead of summer, but when you're out there and you've got... You're either digging holes, or you're walking through rice-type paddies or streams or just whatever it is, and the humidity's so high and the temperature's up there and you're sweating and dirty and grimy, and you're that way for a couple of, sometimes, you know, a couple of weeks, 10 days maybe. But I think we all probably pretty much smelled the same, so you didn't notice.
Is there any truth to being able to smell the enemy? You know, I've heard that too.
The only thing I think you could, I don't know what you'd smell, but I heard that too. And maybe if they're thinking they're smelling fish sauce or something like that. But I think that the number of times that I actually saw the enemy when they would have been dead or wounded anyway. And your adrenaline's going so fast, you're not smelling. You know, we would, once in a while, we would come through well, I called it a way station. We came upon once that was like a big holding area that had big bags of rice and all these, you know, kinds of things there. And I think they'd been there a few days prior, and I don't remember smelling anything. But also, when you're wandering around there, the last thing I'm worried about is smelling, because I'm worried about they've got booby traps set all through this place that we're looking at.
Right.
So I don't remember ever smelling them.
Okay. Could you comment on the issue of bravery? This always comes up when you're talking about war and heroes and how people act under fire. What did you witness?
Oh, boy, bravery. I would think the bravery, from what I saw the most of, is when someone would get wounded, whether it be the big booby trap that hurt us so bad, or when one of our group would step on a mine, then pretty much caution was tossed aside, and the medics you would have would be sprinting up a trail, you know, not worrying about hitting another mine or a toe popper, or whoever was around would be just thought, the only thing you thought about was taking care of the one person or whoever it was wounded and saving their life, and they weren't thinking of anything else. Bravery as far as in battles go, I never was involved in any giant battles. They were just snipers and, you know, 10-second skirmish type things. Most of mine was mines. I didn't have any. Didn't ever saw any Audie Murphy type guys.
Okay. I've also talked to many veterans who say, you know, I did witness some pretty incredible acts, but, you know, we didn't really see it that way. And we don't really see it that way now either. Is that how you all felt?
Oh, you mean they said they didn't see any incredible acts, or they did?
No, that they did, and that, you know, they didn't see it as such a...
Oh, at the time?
Yeah, or now. They just say that this was something that was, you know, we were just doing what we do.
And I think that's probably right. I think that most of the time the people would take on a either, well, we had one instance, I guess, where we had surrounded a couple of guys in a thicket, and we were in a horseshoe, and everybody kind of shot the thing up. And I don't remember anybody. I mean, I was a little bit concerned about one of our own guys shooting me because we were in a kind of a semicircle shooting in the same hole. But nobody seemed to be overly afraid. They were just there. The mission was to kill these two that we had ran into the middle of this little thicket, which was successful in doing. And but I know I had an uncle. I mentioned got the Bronze Star for Valor over there, and from what I read, and he won't talk about it much, but he hauled a bunch of people out of under enemy fire and saved a bunch of the wounded people in one of the big battle he had. And to him, it's not a big deal. He just did not even talk about it. And it was probably pretty heroic for him, too. Mm-hmm.
Did you get awarded anything like that?
No, not as far. You know, I got the same old stuff. I was what you call just your average grunt. You know, we got the CIB and
right. Yeah,
the Army Commendation Medal and the Vietnam Service Medal and nothing spectacular. One of our real good friends, Jerry Nichols is his name. He got the Silver Star. He'll never say it, but I do. Every time we're at one reunion and anybody wants to bring something up, I pretty much point out that he got the Silver Star. It was for saving a, he was on a, I think it was a dust off that was trying to take some people out, and they ended up shooting the pilot, and the thing crashed with him in it. And I think Jerry had made it through that, but had been shot in the stomach, but also had managed to get hold of a weapon and return fire. And I think he was trying to protect the other chopper pilot. I never heard all the details except from some of the other guys. That was right before I got there. But that's probably there. You go to some that kind of valor that he acts like it wasn't a big deal, but pretty special. Now that I think, but I didn't happen to be there. But I just after the fact, and I know he's got the medal, and I've actually got a picture I found earlier, and this one kind of we call it the Blue Book. It's like a yearbook that I have that's got him being awarded the Silver Star.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How was the leadership in Vietnam?
I thought ours was fine, but you only see what you have. And the lieutenants we had, except the one that had one of our fellows shooting in the foot we talked about earlier, most of them, the lieutenants were okay. In fact, the three or four that I've been able to get a hold of, and that some of them, they come to reunions and things, they're just great guys. Once you got much higher than that, I think a lot of us had problems, and it wouldn't have been that their leadership was so bad. I think it was coming out of the 60s, and like myself being 18 years old, being in a place I didn't want to be, and having them, I mainly was exposed to them once we got back more in the rear and things. And I had the one instance where I had, we'd just come back in, and I had, we're heading to the EM club, been cleaned up, and we'd been out for a couple of weeks. But Major Davenport, that was his name, whether he's still alive or not, I don't know, but he nabbed me and told me to get a haircut, and I didn't think it was that bad, so I thought, oh man. So I head back, and they had a barber there at the battalion that actually I'd come in country with, and when we were standing there to get orders, they asked if anybody had a special skill or a job, and he said he'd just been to barber school. Well, talk about lucking out. He ended up being the battalion barber his whole tour.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So anyway, I go back to get my first haircut from him, and I think his last name was Anderson. But get a haircut, and we talk well, and I'm heading. It would be a thing that it was stupid to want to have your hair fairly long over there. It made no difference, but I don't know what it was. But everybody had their hair back long in the States, so got a little bit taken off. I'm heading back down this dirt road, heading to the EM club, and sure enough, there was Major Davenport again. And he tightens me up there in the spot, tells him to go back. I go back, get another one, a little bit here and there, and believe it or not, I'm almost within a 50 feet of the EM club, and he comes around the corner again, and this time he puts me in the back of his Jeep, drives me back to the barber, and then I get a real haircut. So I got three haircuts within about an hour. That story came out in Vietnam Magazine a couple months ago.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. So it was, it's one of those funny ones. You know, it was written up as funny, and it wasn't funny then, but it kind of is now. But to me, I didn't know what the big concern was. You know, they left us alone as far as our dress code went out there at that time. Our unit, they left us completely alone. But to be back in the rear and be there for just a couple of days, you know, for me to have to get your, you know, get these tight haircuts. I'm sure he was doing his job, but I didn't see any sense of it.
How did you all wear your hair in the field? Mostly.
Yeah, mostly it was. Most of the people didn't do the white walls or tie it on the sides. You kept it as long as you could. Mine was probably a little longer than average. Still is. It's just that's how I kind of liked it. We had one of the fellows. He kind of I think John Bales. He had a hawk mow, we call it, not a mohawk, so he'd let it grow a little bit and then just run the clippers right down the middle of it and shave the center of his head. I don't know if that looked scarier or what. But this normal haircut, you couldn't get them very long anyhow.
Yeah. Tell me about humor and how that played a role in your tour.
Well, we had a lot of good times. I have always said that. When people would ask me to go, I'd say, I had a lot of good times and a few bad times. And people try to focus on the bad times. But, you know, we can laugh. We laugh at things at the reunions that were scary at the time. And I know I talked about a couple of them. We had with the big fella Tate throwing the hand grenades at the Popular Force guys at night. And that, I mean, it could have killed a bunch of them, but now we laugh about it. You know, we had a case I talked about with everybody jumping out of the canal because there was a eel swimming down the middle of it. Yeah, we weren't afraid of the VC or anybody shooting us when we got down the side of the bank right there. We just didn't want the eel to touch us. So there was a lot of that. And, you know, we did a lot of cutting up, and I think in the rear, I've got some pictures of everybody posing with some guy's big Bowie knife, and on the China Beach there, we've all got swimming suits on, and I don't know what we were doing, but a lot of grab ass would go on, but it was a way to unwind. I don't remember really any practical jokes or anything happening then. It was, most of the time when we were in the rear, we were either writing letters, waiting for the EM club to open, or we were lucky enough that our rear area, Hooch, was sitting right on the beach. So, didn't appreciate it as much as we should have. But
right.
It was there.
Okay. You've described the weather and everything there. I'd like to kind of talk about the country, the physical layout of the country. What did you see, and how do you see it now?
Well, I know there's a four or five star resort just about 5 miles from where our rear area was.
That's right.
Yeah, it's down around the Neely area. Mm-hmm. I saw that on the internet the other day.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the most beautiful country I think anybody could see, especially where we were. Climate-wise, it was a little rough, but you got the China Sea there, you got the most beautiful beaches, and then there was the flatlands were there, and then it would go up into the mountains. And it was, I think if you were to go back today, we'd probably appreciate it a lot more. At the time, of course, I grew up in the mountains and with the beach. And it wasn't anything new for me to see, but now that I think of the waterfalls and the things up in the mountains we had, plus the beautiful beaches, it was destined to be a resort area.
Mm-hmm. And what about the terrain when you're out in the field?
Terrain was, if we were down in the flatlands, that was pretty much, that was the best, we thought, because you could see forever. We were always closer to the villages, so we knew that during the day we'd probably be approached by the what we called the soda girls that would be bringing out trinkets and pop and things and beer you could buy from them, and it was a way to break up the day. So it was easy walking. Ambushes were easy because we mainly just were all in a certain area on flatlands around rice paddy dikes. The mountains were probably the worst just because of the terrain and the weight that we carried from up and down the hills. And also a lot of the vegetation in the valleys between the mountains, I think the leeches would be the worst in those places.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a little tougher getting your resupply in. And a lot of the things in the mountains we had, if we were too afraid of the booby traps in the mines, we always carried a machete, and it was very slow going. We would just hack and chop and take turns trying to move up hills or through different areas, and then that would just be a couple feet at a time. So that was the most miserable with the mountains. I think most pretty, but miserable.
Right. It's nice from a distance, but not walking around.
Yeah, you don't have to walk through when you're carrying your livelihood on your back.
Right. What about the Vietnamese civilians, and did you guys ever participate in any kind of civic action?
We had a. I liked them, but most of them. I think. I think it kind of went both ways. Some of the fellows were pretty hostile. We had an instance where we were walking out, and I don't think we were in what we call quite a free fire zone, which was just outside of Chu Lai in the flatlands. So we came upon a couple of woodcutters that one of the fellows, I think, wasn't getting the right answers and knocked him upside the head with a bloop gun and put a gash in his cheek. Well, the fella hit, and he probably shouldn't have. I don't know if they were in the right or wrong spot, but they were probably only 40 years old, but they looked 80, I think, to take the toll on them when they were living there. Well, it wasn't long after that we get a radio message that a colonel's on his way out. I forgot who it was, though. We looked because the civilian had run back and had told somebody, which had called them, and so I remember the fellow named Donnie Johnson that hit him. And they sent out this colonel on this little loach and came out, and they took Johnson aside, and they didn't haul him back in there. And I think they might have let him go, but it could have been pretty serious. I think they didn't want us harassing the civilians very bad. The only other ones that I ever ran into where I got to know some of the workers that would work back in the rear area, as far as you'd have the girls that worked in the EN clubs, and they would help them with the kitchen help and things like that. And they pretty much were, I thought, real decent people.
Okay. Today, looking back at them, do you still feel the same way?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, most of them didn't want any part of that either. You know, the majority of them, I think that's why we're so well received to go back and visit. I know some of the guys I talked to said they don't want any part of ever going back. You know, I would be real interested to look up some of the people that I got to know. Most of them I did get to know were some of the girls that were there, and they were, that would work in the Ian clubs and things, and also we'd call them hooch maids. They would also clean around the area. So I never had any kind of fling with any of them, but they were just, you know, me being 18 and 19, and they probably a couple of years younger, and they were there doing their job. But I hesitate because I would like to go see them, and I think they'd like to see me. But I would think that I don't know how it would be taken as far as their families would go, families and spouses and things. You know, if you were to go back and try to look them up and then either rekindle some memories or what people might not know that they were actually, you know, working inside the base and stuff in their teenage years. I don't know how that would come across. I'd have to test the water when I got there and see. So, but it'd be interesting to see what happened to them. I'm just afraid some of them, probably the repercussions of fraternizing with us as far as just in the, you know, working with us, probably came down hard on them once we were out of there, I guess.
Yeah. This is Dr. Richard Verone continuing my oral history interview with Dave Hammond. This is done for the Vietnam Archives Oral History Project. Today is May 31st, 2006. Dave's in Beaverton, Oregon, and I'm in Lubbock, Texas. Dave, why don't we continue with where we were? You had come back to Fort Lewis, and where did you go? What did you do once you came home and kind of got back into life stateside?
Well, the home was, I had a 30-day leave. I was one of the regular Army people, so I had time after Vietnam. So when I came home and pretty much slept a lot, ate a lot. I think the last time we talked, we talked about the things that were real different for me, and it was sidewalks and doorknobs and glass on windows. So yeah. Once I got accustomed to to all of that, and I'd had orders to go to Fort Carson, Colorado to be a drill sergeant, and while I was home in Springfield, Oregon, I got orders again to change that, to report to Fort Lewis. So they were winding the war down. They didn't need drill sergeants. So, I was sent to Fort Lewis to be a tank commander from then on.
And so you're really transferring back to what you were supposed to be doing.
Right. I had all the training, right, and I went back and was assigned a tank. Actually, it was a real decent duty. You wouldn't think so at the time. So a little bit of the issue I had was I was 19 years old still. Mm-hmm. I've been to Vietnam and back and came back a buck sergeant. And
that's incredible, Dave. At age 19, you've been through a war experience.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think I did okay. I mean, not as far as I don't mean okay as far as being some kind of big hero or a soldier. I think I just did my job, but I think I was very fortunate that I think mentally could adjust, and I think not getting ahead of it. But I think I did okay in life. I think even from then, I had some bumps along the way, but I look back on it now, and most of the fellows in my unit that I see a lot there. Most of them 2, 3, 4, 5 years older, you know, than I am. And I think the one reason I ended up over and back so fast is because I did join right out of high school on what we call the delayed entry program. My birthday fell in August. So it was just kind of one of those things. But I did, when I got to Fort Lewis and was assigned a tank, I was one of the few people that had been to Vietnam because most of the guys coming back either extended or were out of the service because they were 2-year draftees.
Right.
Or you could volunteer to get drafted for 2 years. So I was one of the few. And the duty was decent. But one thing, not just because I was an NCO with some of the enlisted fellows there, there was always a little bit of a rub, I guess, with some of them. But after I'd been there a couple of months, I had one of them approach me and tell me that everybody was very standoffish to begin with. And what had happened was they thought I was what they called a narc or an informer of some kind, because nobody could figure out how young I was, and I had the rank, and all of a sudden I showed up and was a tank commander and still in the service and very young, looked very young. And once I got to know them and they realized I wasn't a plant in there, because the drugs were pretty hot and heavy in Fort Lewis at the time. So I did fine. But I had in my own room. There was a mess hall down below. I had a fairly new car parked out front, and it was basically a 7 to 4:30 Monday through Friday job.
Mm-hmm.
So it was okay.
Tell me about you mentioned the drug problem.
That was always a problem. You know, it was really bad in Vietnam. But we got here, and I think one of the first days or two when I was sent to the motor pool, my tank number was 13, but I couldn't find my crew. I was walking around the motor pool and realized all the hatches were closed on this tank.
Mm-hmm.
Well, after I started banging on the tank and the door opened up, they were all down there smoking dope. So it was, and I think that's where we got off on the real wrong foot. You know, I was to be in charge, and you know, I didn't report them or write them up, but we, you know, had some words. But that's what was going on. It was a lot of course, again, being in 1971, we were still on the tail end of what the sick was going on in the 60s as far as the culture was going on in the United States. So I think the hippie movement was still there.
Yeah. Was there a discipline problem overall that you noticed in the Army?
It was a little bit better, I think, in the States. In Vietnam, people tried to leave each other alone as much as they could just to get through it over there. I think that they did tighten it up some here back in the States. So I think that there was a less tolerance as far as if people would have gone AWOL or disobeyed orders. I think there would have been some problems. I don't really remember very many of them. In fact, I don't remember any real problems. Anybody got in much more trouble than just kind of getting chewed out.
Yeah. At age 19, how comfortable did you feel being a commander and being a leader?
Not very. That was always one of the things. You know, I was fine having my own tank and having a crew of three. There was a training center in Yakima, Washington, which is about a 3-hour drive from Fort Lewis, Washington, and that's where we would go for a field exercises once a year. And I always wanted to be an instructor there. I got to know the fellows that were instructors. There was only about a dozen of them. It would have been great duty. And One quick story is we had kind of backfired, but I got to know the instructors, and I thought, what a great life that would be. Well, they wrote up this glowing letter and sent it back to my unit in Fort Lewis about I was just what they were looking for, and on and on and on, and a lot of grandiose things. Well, once the people read it in my unit, there was no way they were going to let go of me, so I was pretty much stuck where I was for the rest of the time, which wasn't bad, but... I think that's probably what I would have liked to have done is to have been an instructor somewhere, not necessarily ride around on a tank.
What had changed in the training that you were overseeing versus the training that you went through previous?
Well, the training that we had on as far as on the tanks and the weapons, that was pretty basic. Again, once I got to Vietnam, I never saw a tank. And came back, I really was pretty easy to pick up. And I think I might have mentioned before that anybody that's got any kind of brains at all could kind of operate any one of the systems on the tanks. They're real easy. And basically, it was a lot of maintenance. Those things were breaking down constantly, and it was mainly a keep your tank maintained and motor pool, and then we would go kind of play some kind of war once in a while out in the outskirts of the Fort Lewis area, which would always kind of amaze me because they were still using the battle tactics that you would probably see when you watch the movie Patton, and which probably never going to happen again.
Right. That's something I wanted to follow up with is uh-huh. How much of a role did you see the Army placing on tanks in warfare?
Well, of course, I didn't see any, but when I went through training, one of the things that happened was the movie Patton with George C. Scott, it had come out, so we as tankers and going through training watched Patton's mm-hmm. movie at Fort Knox, Kentucky, and saw what they did in World War II. But again, we didn't have any idea. Most of us didn't really know what to expect in Vietnam anyhow. So the few fellows that did see, I think, the smaller tanks, they were in just the bigger, the Saigon areas and the Da Nang areas, and I don't think there was, they sure wouldn't have been in the mountains where I ended up.
So you guys watch Patton. What was that like? What kind of effect did that have on you all?
Well, pretty patriotic. You know, whether you were a draftee or a regular Army, it was when you saw George G. Scott standing there in front of that great big flag, you know, it was a patriotic thing to see, and we felt pretty important, you know, and to have teenagers and people in their early 20s on these, I don't know how what those things, the tanks were worth, but it felt pretty important to be able to be turned loose on that kind of equipment. And
sure.
I guess felt some kind of I guess, I don't know if you'd call it power or not, but they were an awesome type of machine to be on.
Mm-hmm. Did any of the guys that you were working with and training, they ask you about Vietnam and about the war?
You know, not many of them. And again, I've said before that unless somebody was actually there, most of us didn't talk about it at all. In fact, I had the one friend I did have was an E6 staff sergeant. Had the room next to mine, and he hadn't been there either, so I don't recall anybody in that tank unit I was in that had been to Vietnam. So I think our company commander, I know he was a warrant officer, but mm-hmm. we never talked about it. But again, unless someone had actually been there, there was a period from when the guys would get out till probably just a few years back where nobody would didn't want to talk about it anyhow because people wouldn't understand what you were talking about.
Didn't you find that kind of strange?
Yeah, I always thought it was real strange, and I thought it was the one thing I got real tired of, and I wrote a story on it, too, that was I got real tired of, and I still do, of people making excuses why they weren't there. And most of them will when they see my bumper sticker or my hat sitting on my dashboard or the question will come up, and they'll say, oh, you were there, and I'm going to acknowledge it, but the next sentence almost every time is, well, my lottery was this or my lottery was that or my lottery number. There was an excuse that how they didn't happen to go there or how they had a college deferment or there's many things. But to me, you know, and most of them are waiting for, well, you didn't miss much or you're lucky you didn't have to go. And I get real tired of that. So mm-hmm. I don't even acknowledge them anymore.
Yeah. Is the time when you are able to discuss things really at the reunions versus, say, with your family or close friends?
Close friends I can. Some. My family's heard most of it. The reunions, all that's always a good time because we were actually together. But even when I run into vets, no matter where I'm at, and you can tell, you know, there's a common denominator there that you can throw a few things out and understand what each other's talking about. Mm-hmm. So that's easier.
Let me ask you a couple questions about the climate of the United States. Mm-hmm. When you came back in the early 70s. This is a period of when we were, the United States was in a period of transitioning the war over to the South Vietnamese called Vietnamization. Did you think that there was a chance that this kind of thing would work, turning the war to the South Vietnamese for them to handle?
Boy, you know, again, as young as I was, I didn't pay a lot of attention to it, but I had a gut feeling it was never going to happen. Just because, and it didn't surprise me at all when watching the news, when to see the South Vietnamese caving in like they did. They couldn't hold their own unless we were with them anyway over there.
Mm-hmm.
So I would imagine with the corrupt government they had, there was just no way they were going to make it without us. You know, we would be there today. You know, if it was to stay in North and South Vietnam, but it's. It doesn't surprise me that they didn't last.
Is that your opinion of that, basically? Is that today, or were you thinking about that?
No, that was then. I knew what had happened. It didn't surprise me. You know, the sad thing is that we, and again, with the war we're in now, but we lost so many people, and we're right back to square one again. That's the downfall. If you, as in, say, World War II, when we actually won the war and things got better for the world. Unlike Vietnam, you know, we lost our 58,000 and of our people, and how many hundreds of thousands of the Vietnamese people lost, and they went right back to what they were doing and before we even got there. So,
yeah.
I mean, that's just a waste.
What did you think of the anti-war movement?
I didn't like it. I still don't. And a lot of them acted like it wasn't an insult to us, but it really was because we knew what was going on when we were over there. We were over there and guys were dying and we were having a tough time of it. And to see the protesters, it just always rubbed me the wrong way, you know, because they were hurting the families just as much as they were the soldiers. So you would see that. And, you know, right or wrong, to me, if they would have kept it to themselves, that would have been better.
Did you feel like they were exercising freedom of speech, or was it more, you know?
They had freedom of speech, but you know, I don't care to hear. I didn't care to hear about it, and I don't know if everything you read's true. But as far as with some of the protesters, the Jane Fondas and stuff, that they actually supposedly made it worse for the POWs. I just don't like it. The war protesting that was going on. You know, the burning of the flags and the tearing stuff up. I don't even know how to put it in words, but yeah, I don't have much. In fact, I don't have any kind of respect for any of them that did that. And even the ones that went to Canada, whether the war is right or wrong, it was like it. And like maybe it's selfish, but sometimes I felt like getting back to the people, make an excuse why they didn't have to go that are our age, that are my age. And you know, it's. I guess it's never been fair, you know, the draft or whatever it's been. But, mm-hmm. you know, I felt if one goes, everybody goes. It would be, there shouldn't be a selective why certain people don't have to do things. And some of the privileged few, I guess, didn't have to go. But, it wasn't a fair thing as far as who did go and who didn't go.
What about the Vietnam Veterans Against the War, the VVAW?
Yeah, I don't know what to think of those guys. And I didn't pay much attention to them too, as far as the carries and stuff when they were, you know, early on. I don't think I paid any attention to them at all. And they've got a right to do what they want to do. And I have more respect for them because they were actually there. So to me, they've got a legit firsthand knowledge of what happened and how wrong it was. So, you know, unlike the people that ran off to Canada and got amnesty. Yeah, I have more respect for them. So, again, you know, everybody can think what they want. I just don't care to hear it.
Okay. What did you think about the My Lai? Because as a member of the AmeriCal division, that, you know, My Lai is part of the history of your division.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, you had nothing to do with that, and right. So few people had something to do with that. But, you know, I heard that on the news last night, just comparing things happening in Iraq right now with the Marines.
I heard that.
Yeah. I mean, they brought up My Lai again. They said, you know, this incident in Iraq is kind of like the modern-day My Lai. And I just wanted to ask you what your thoughts were on that and what you remember at the time being said about it.
Yeah, it was always a stigma that was had with the AmeriCal. You know, it always will be. I had somebody stop me a year or so ago, and I had a sticker on my bumper, and I was walking into a bookstore, office store, and a guy said, well, wasn't that one of Lieutenant Calley's areas? And I said, well, we were close, but it'll always be remembered that way. If I would have been in that group, I know I wouldn't have been part of the shooting of the women, children, and innocent people. There's a certain point where you might be enraged over what had happened to some of your fellow soldiers, but there's kind of a sense of some kind of common sense and decency out there. What amazes me is the courage that the helicopter pilot. Was it two helicopter pilots and a couple of door gunners, maybe? They're the fellows that brought the helicopter down in between Callie's bunch and some of the civilians that they hadn't killed yet. And there was a standoff with weapons drawn between the two of them.
Correct,
That's pretty heroic. Yeah, those guys, there should have been some medals awarded to them for that. But as far as what happened and to getting caught up in revenge, I think it probably happened more than we all know. Maybe not on that large of a scale, but that just puts us right back into the barbaric things that we're always supposedly against as Americans. So it sure wasn't right.
What about Kent State?
Yeah, Kent State. That's too bad. I actually feel sorry for the National Guard people in that one. From what main thing I can remember, though, is looking, I think it was Life magazine. But I can understand what would happen when you've got a bunch of National Guard, most of them I think were in their latter teens, I would guess, a lot of them, and probably ill-trained, and then surrounded with rock throwing and flame or Molotov cocktail type throwing or whatever they had. And the chaos was to start, and as I remember, they ran them up a hill. I think they were probably pretty much panicked. And if they were trying to protect themselves, I guess that's one thing. It was a bad situation all the way around. But again, if the students wouldn't have been either chasing them or throwing their rocks and their bottles and everything at them, it probably wouldn't have happened. But, of course, the other side is going to say, you know, you don't want the military showing up to stop their war protest either. So there's always two sides to those stories, but I do feel sorry for the fellas that were in uniform there.
Did you keep up with the war when you came home and what was happening?
Just a little bit on the news. Like I said before, I knew when things started caving in, it didn't surprise me. You know, but at the time, most of us, middle 70s, we were just trying to forget about it. We didn't have any.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In fact, I had a box out in my garage that I had a copy of what we called a yearbook that I think some Filipino photographers came over and spent a couple of days with us, and has pictures of all of us in it. And every now and then I'd go out there in that garage and drink a few beers and look for my box of stuff. So I always kept the memory was there, I think. I didn't dwell on it as far as news and things. I just kind of kept it in mind. And I think that's why I had an easy time when I did locate the bunch of the group I was with. I remembered, I think, a lot more of them than they probably remembered some of us, because I was looking at their picture, you know, at least once a month in this book I had. So that did help.
What did you feel in April 1975 when you saw South Vietnam collapsing and the helicopters being pushed off the aircraft carriers and that whole thing playing out on TV?
Yeah, I think I was just amazed they got out of there. Again, I felt some grief for the South Vietnamese that were left behind. And I kind of still do. And there's some of the people I got to know there that who knows what happened to them once we left, you know, as far as I know there are the re-education camps and things you hear of, but anybody that was worked with us or collaborated with the Americans, I'm sure they had a rough time of it once we were gone, which is too bad. You know, when you take and turn and leave people like that, that was bad. And it'd be like the Mountain Yards we talked about. Those poor people I know were persecuted and probably many of them killed, you know, once we were gone, just because they fought with us.
Well, looking after 1975 and, you know, the dominance of Vietnam now and that area, you know, over Laos and Cambodia, and having our ally Thailand there, people mention the domino effect, you know, the domino theory way back in the 1950s and early 60s is one of the reasons why we went to war, because all the countries would fall and go to communism, but that didn't happen.
Right.
What are your thoughts on that? I mean, looking back at it now, is one of the big reasons why, the president gave us, you know, the public saying, listen, this is why we need to go.
Yeah.
And looking also, just what do you think of what happened? You know, was this a piece of Cold War? Did it, because the countries did not go communist, you know, what role does that play?
I know, you know, I hadn't thought of that in a long time, but the domino theory, because we all knew that back then. That's what we were always told. You know, every time one other country becomes communist, it's just a matter of time. We have to stop them where they're at.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what I feel now, as time goes on, it shows you that communism isn't going to hardly make. I mean, China's hanging in there. They're doing okay. But
right.
Other than that, I mean, what's happened to Russia, Cuba, that's a disaster as far as their, you know, economies go.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess now, with all these years to look back, communism isn't really much of a threat. I think that, you know, dictatorship maybe is kind of more of a threat in some of these countries. But in that domino theory, I never thought about it, but you're right. It doesn't mean much now. I don't even think anybody thinks about it.
Yeah. One of the things that Richard Nixon and Kissinger said after the Paris peace talks wrapped up is that America had withdrawn and achieved peace with honor. Can you make some comments on that?
Yeah, I don't think there was any peace with honor. That was no peace. I got to hand it to him. He got us out of there. I think that was more of a cut our losses and leave. The way that was going, they weren't going to let anybody win the war. And whether we could have ever won it anyhow, I kind of doubt it. So, and it really, when they called peace, it wasn't peace for the people we left behind. So, I think it was just it was one way we could get out.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on the media coverage of the war?
I think it was good. Unlike, I heard a thing on the news, I think this morning or last night, that with what's happened in Iraq, people, you can't see any of the war. That war there has taken such a different turn that the news media can't hardly venture out of the secured areas. And in Vietnam, we did have some control. I know they've lost a lot of the media people, but, you know, like they say, that was the first war that was in everybody's living rooms, which I think probably helped fuel the fire for the protesters and things like that, and maybe a better understanding for everybody what was really going on over there. But I think I never really saw any of the media people. I don't remember any of them ever being with us, but I think they probably did a good job, because there's sure a lot of footage and books and photos and what they got. You know, they had pretty much, I don't think they were restricted much in Vietnam. I think they pretty much had their anywhere they wanted to go. They did okay.
Okay. This idea of fighting 1 year in a war and then coming home versus, you know, what the American experience was in World War I and World War II in Korea, where you served kind of the duration. Did you think that the 1 year rotation policy was a good idea or a bad idea?
If we would have had a goal, and I think maybe early on in the middle 60s when the war started up, I think the fellows that went over there, and I think if there was a goal that we could win, and if any of us knew that we're here, we've got unlimited support, and if once we win this war, it's over, everybody goes home, I think it would have been a different mindset. But what we knew was, is we had 1 year to serve over there, and then we were coming home. So as we talked before, and me being there so late on in the conflict, that winning wasn't even a question in my mind. There was nothing to win. It was just, the win was get out of there all in one piece, you know, and come home. And everybody I knew was that way. But I think most of us, if there would have been a goal out there that we've got to win this thing and it can be done till we can all come home, it would have changed the mindset of most everybody. I think we would have been way more aggressive than we were.
What about the body count policy? This wasn't really in effect when you were there, but it was there. I mean, basically, this is one of Westmoreland's plans. The more we kill of them, the more likely they're not going to be able to meet that force. They have a limited number of people to throw at this thing, and the more we hit them, the better off we'll be, and the war will end sooner. What did you think about that?
Well, they sure had enough bodies kept coming down there, though. That's so I don't know. And later on, you know, when I was there, it probably made sense. But my God, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands you'd have to wipe out. I mean, you know, what is the count of how many we estimated that them died, the North Vietnamese died?
Well, the conservative estimate is, you know, total Vietnamese, South and North, you know, around 1 million.
Wow.
And the high estimates I've seen, you know, 2, 3 to 4 million.
Jeez.
So it's probably, I mean, we really don't know. Hanoi has not let those records out or really hasn't given exact body counts. But they're, you know, it's near 1 million, I would guess, total.
Well, and it just shows you the unlimited supply, because even as late as we were there, and with all of the firepower we had, our whole job was trying to stop the supply routes and the infiltration, you know, into the cities and the towns and the villages we were around. So I never ever thought of ever being a shortage of body counts. The only thing I can ever remember, I kind of kept a mental tally I touched on before, that for every mission we were on, which was usually lasted a couple of weeks, 10 days, whatever it was, we always lost. And it wouldn't have been for actually people dying, but as far as if you wanted to add up the wounded, their side versus ours, we always lost. We always lost a couple of guys to mines or something. And once in a while, we might end up, you know, killing one of them. So I think in the long run, I know we came out on the short end of the stick.
Tell me what your thoughts are on the overall policy of the United States. You know, you've kind of touched on that here in the last few answers. But looking overall, what did we do right? What did we do wrong? I know that's a big question.
Yeah, big question. But I'm not so sure we should have even been there to begin with, because I don't know enough about it. I know you I'm sure you know all there is from your research, but...
No, I don't. But I don't know if we'll ever have all the answers. But
it's one of those things that it's, you know, how does the United States selectively choose these certain countries to move into? You know, we've got other horrendous things happening in Africa and things that are just mind-boggling that we're not involved with, probably because somebody smart enough to know we can't help them really much. But you know, the policy. I don't know. That's for the politicians. I don't really know. I look back on it now and think we probably should have never gone. But at the time, I thought we were still kind of in the end of the John Wayne thing, where you flag wavers, and if Uncle Sam says, you know, he needs us, well, you know, by God, let's go. You know, that's what we're supposed to do. But looking back on it again, as I said before, it was pretty much a waste of, you know, if you talk about 1 million Vietnamese and 60,000. And that's just the ones that died of us. I mean, how many lives were shattered from being wounded and things? It was probably a mistake.
What about PTSD? And you don't have to answer that if you don't want to. But
I will. I'm mixed on it. I think I probably have some. In fact, I know I have some of the symptoms, I would think. But I sucked it up when I got back. It's my favorite line that didn't happen until 10 years ago, but in The Shawshank Redemption, the guy says, you know, get busy living or get busy dying. And it's one of those things that we all were affected, some more than others. I always did say, though, that the people that were over there, there were some of them shouldn't have been there. They were mentally unstable anyhow when they got to Vietnam, and it was just worse to have them there. But the PTSD, you know, it covers such a broad scope. You know, you can pretty much make up anything you want, and they can say you've got PTSD. And to me, it's how you deal with it. I'm a little upset about all the claims that are paid to some of the people that absolutely don't need them. Well, I know some of the vets in our group. They're driving, you know, $100,000 motorhomes with fancy Jeeps and motorcycles strapped in trailers on the back of them, and they're supposedly 100% disabled. Well, I wouldn't mind having a $100,000 motorhome and a Harley on the back and drawing a check, but I don't need it. You know, I mean, I've done okay, and most of those people don't need it. And there's a lot of people, vets, and I know some of them, that are getting the same 10% that they were awarded when they got wounded pretty bad, you know, back when they were in Vietnam, and they've decided to get on with their life and make a living and do what they want. But it's just, to me, it's not fair. If the person that wants to go push that system and knows how to work the system, and there's many books out there on how to get these claims, a lot of them are unjustified, and I think there's a lot of guys out there that I've even tried to get some of them to go get a higher level, just because I think they've got the either PTSD or their wounds were bad enough. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I guess I'm mixed on it. I think some of it's just kind of a fake. But
you mentioned. Go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say I just don't think they're all for real. I think it's a lot of the way for these guys to get a second, you know, retirement check.
Okay. That's interesting. I've heard that before from veterans, and some are very adamantly opposed to such things, and you know that this PTSD is really just not real.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, except if there's a physical wound.
Sure.
But the whole mental aspect of it is up in the air, I know, with a lot of folks.
Well, PTSD, I mean, the 9/11 people have it. I mean, you can have it from anything. You know, car crash, all kinds of things, you can come up with some kind of PTSD. It's just, I guess it's just each to their own, as far as what's real and what's not. I just don't like people taking advantage of the system.
Sure. Well, you mentioned that you suffer some of the symptoms, or you recognize some of this.
Well, I have. I've had it's a sleeping disorder, which I didn't realize how strange it was. Well, I guess I always knew it was kind of strange. But I got it. I started it, I know, right soon after I got back from Vietnam. But and this may sound weird, and my whole family knows. I mean, everybody I know knows it because they think I'm a kind of an oddball for doing it. But every night, I got a handheld radio with an earphone, and I have to have that earphone in my ear with some kind of talk. It's not music. It's got to be a voice, whether it's NPR news or talk, and I have to have this background music, and it goes all night long, and I sleep in and out of it. A lot of times it wraps around in dreams, but it's a way to, and I don't know what I'm trying to block out from thinking about, but I have to have it. So it's either I've got a separate set of batteries I carry with me when I travel, I got an extra earphone. It's just different. And once in a while I have not had it, and I've done okay, but I still, every night I've got this earphone in my ear, and it's I don't know what to even call it. I don't know, Richard. I don't know what to call it, except that everybody thinks I'm an oddball when they say something about it. But it's a way for me, I guess, to not think, you know, about certain things. So,
yeah.
And I don't know what I'm not trying to think about, because I'm not really. I mean, everything that ever happened to me, especially in Vietnam, I talked about. So I'm not quite sure what that's about. But I think a sleeping disorder is one of them. You have a problem with. I think people, you know, over time. I don't think I'm an alcoholic. I do like to drink. I'm a beer drinker, along with most everybody else I know. You know, my buddies.
Mm-hmm.
But really not. I don't think to excess. I was never into drugs, trying to cope with anything. And I've been very successful in my life. So the only real weird thing I have is that radio in my ear every night. Oh, God. In fact, my wife, it drives her nuts because every now and then I'll set her and remember the last thing that happened.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, somebody will die or a celebrity gets divorced or something, and God, I'll reach over there and say, guess what? Paul McCartney just got divorced, you know, or something like that. And this is 2 o'clock in the morning. So I'm pretty much up on the news before most people get up.
I feel for her.
Well, the worst part is when I roll over and the thing pulls and falls off and hits the hardwood floor and makes a big bang and the batteries go flying. That really ticks her off.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I guess maybe it's just a comfort thing.
I think so. Yeah, and I did run into, who was that? Another vet here not long ago that he said he'd done that for a few years. He doesn't do it anymore. But when that was brought up, it didn't really surprise him. He said he'd done the same thing for a while.
Huh.
So maybe I'm not the only one. Well, I doubt I am. But.
Yeah. What do you feel about your service today, Dave? How do you see it looking back?
Oh, I say it's probably one of the best things that ever happened to me. And I think I look at that as, because number one, I came back in one piece, very fortunate. I mean, if I would have been sitting here talking to you without any, you know, legs or arm or whatever it might be, it would be a whole different story. Or if I was dying of cancer from Agent Orange, it would be a different story. But the friendship and the memories and the adventure part of this thing, there's nothing like it. I had one of the fellows named Mike Culligan, the first guy that got back a hold of me. We were in the same squad together over there. And he still to this day said he had all kinds of troubles in high school and was going the wrong way. And he said the Army saved his life, and whether, you know, and he made it through too. He did okay. And I'm going to see him again here this June. But I look back on it and everybody asks, and I'll say, hey, we had a whole lot of good times and a few bad times. And that was, to me, that was what Vietnam was like. It was just a few bad times.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, I didn't think it was all that good a time. But I wouldn't trade the friends I have now and the memories. And it was that short snippet of time. You know, I was only over there for 11 months and some odd days or whatever it might have been. But that has a real shape on somebody's life as far as, even what I'm doing now. If I wouldn't have been for my stint there, I wouldn't be so active in the reunion activities we have and all kinds of veteran stuff. You know, I used to go up here. We've got maybe you can see it when you come out, but we've got a living memorial here in Portland that's just beautiful. I was kind of active in getting going 20-some years ago. And it used to be, I haven't done it in a few years, I would take the AmeriCal flag and go up there and just kind of hang out at the ceremonies and run into some vets and stuff and try to get, you know, let them know there was organizations out there as far as AmeriCal goes. And I don't know, I'm proud of what I did.
Is there anything that you would change about it?
Well, I keep saying it's easy to say now,
right.
But I probably would have, if I had any smarts at all, I would have stayed in the service. Again, I've done just fine as far as family and livelihood and everything else, but I think that me coming back at such a young age and wanting to get out and going back to work pumping gas at the same gas station I was in when I left, I didn't really get anywhere. I did go to college for a couple of years on the GI Bill once I did come back, community college, but I was working during the day too. But I kind of look at some of the fellas that did stay, you know, and at the time I could have retired or gotten out of there when I was 38 years old and then done whatever I would have wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I don't have any problems. I'm very fortunate where I'm at, you know, in my life.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that Vietnam is still with the country today?
Uh, mean with America?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Oh, yeah. I think it, in a big way. I think it's starting to, with everything that's going on in Iraq and Iran and Afghanistan that's happening now. I think it's more prevalent than those of us that are affiliated with it or have been there, or people like you that are taking an interest in it, because we've got so much other things going on in the world. But there's a certain age group of us that I think it was, and there were, I'm finding more and more of them that are coming out, I think it's there, but I think we're kind of taking a back seat to the vets that are coming home from these current conflicts.
Mm-hmm.
But I look at us, I used to be, I would look at these World War II fellas sitting at these reunions at the VFWs, and man, I'm telling you, I look around our reunions and think, my God, what happened, you know, because now we're getting to be, you know, I'll be 55 here this summer, but a lot of these guys, they're in the early 60s. And to me, I remember World War II guys are supposed to be in their 60s. Well, now they're in their 80s.
Right.
So things are changing.
Yeah. Tell me about your feelings on the movies that have come out on Vietnam. And you know, do you even watch them? And if you have, which ones have struck you either, or good
yeah.
or bad?
Oh, I like them. Of course, my favorite's Platoon.
Why?
Well, that one to me was, and I've had other guys, friends of mine, say that they couldn't stand the thing. And to me, I thought that was the most real, as far as what I encountered in Platoon, where when Charlie Sheen goes over there, it reminded me somewhat of myself, young guy, pretty naive, that you had your... In part of that, you had what we call the juicers and the dopers. You had the guys doing the drugs or the guys doing the drinking. There was racial issues that were brought out in that. I'm not so sure about the one conflict between the two squad leaders where the Tom Berenger killed Willem Dafoe.
Right.
I'm not so sure about that. But I think that hit, that was probably true because, what was the director's name of that?
Oliver Stone.
Yeah, because he was there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when he tied the music together and things that he'd seen, I mean, because you could tell he'd been there. You know, unlike Apocalypse Now, which I thought was an entertaining movie, and I like Martin Sheen real well in it. But the stuff with Marlon Brando, it was just way too weird. You know, that stuff never happened.
Yeah.
And some of them, I even kind of like some of the Forrest Gump footage that they mm-hmm. did. A little bit of that was kind of real as far as the what little on Vietnam they did show of him. But, you know, some of these, like Coming Home, there's a few of those that showed the problems that the families had when they came home. I guess they're all okay, but you know, first of all, Platoon would be my favorite.
Okay. Did you see We Were Soldiers?
Yeah, it was okay. I don't know why. The movie just didn't do it for me. And I like Mel Gibson. He's great.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe I probably ought to read the book.
Mm-hmm.
Might like that better. But I did see We Were Soldiers, but it just seemed to get real repetitious to me. It was one of my favorites.
Okay. What about books on Vietnam? Do you read about it?
Not so much. The only thing that I've really read in the past is I would read... Well, the one thing that I still have somewhere that I read two or three times was the Medal of Honor book that goes over all the citations given to all the Medal of Honor winners.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that is very interesting. You know, I read that. But as far as books written by vets, I've read parts of a few of them. The only one that I really, really enjoyed was Tim O'Brien's. You know, Things We Carried.
Yeah.
That's a great book. Again, though, he was a grunt. In fact, he was with the AmeriCal, I think. It was in either Delta Company or something real close to right where I was within about a year, I think. We were just close together there. But you can tell the way he wrote it, what he wrote about, he was really there, and he wasn't grandstanding on anything. And he told the truth. And he, like many of us, he ended up with a rear job driving a Jeep or something towards the end. So... And he's a great writer.
Mm-hmm. So you're not adverse to actually continuing to put yourself back into that scenario, looking at Vietnam and the war, versus some veterans really just don't want to see the movies, don't want to read the books, don't really want to talk about it. You seem to be very open with it.
Oh, I like it. There was nothing that's, you have to, it doesn't, you know, help, I guess, keeping it all inside of you. It's too bad. I've got one of the fellas that was wounded from one of the, small booby traps that we hit. He only lives about an hour from me here. Now I'm almost two. And I talked to his wife twice over the years. I'm talking about a lot of years. And I'd send him a couple of notes, and one here not long ago about the reunion. And a lot of the fellas get together would like to see him. And I guess he doesn't want any part of us, so I'm just going to kind of back off and leave him alone. But we've been in contact with a few of the fellas that, I mean, we were really close with over there, and they don't want any part of it. So I guess it's one of those things that, you know, we can ask once or twice, and if they don't want to partake, it's too bad. I think they're really missing something. I think if they would actually get together, a lot of them would probably never miss one of these. And then on the other hand, we've had some where we've gotten together with some of our people who showed up once, and it was great times, but we'll probably never see them again. So I guess everybody deals with it differently.
Sure. Would you want to go back to Vietnam?
Yeah. In fact, my oldest son got me a trip a few years back, paid for type trip, and then all the kind of circumstances kept happening, and we never got to go. So I've still got plans to go. I had my itinerary all laid out where I was going to go. I don't want to go due to the tourist thing. I mainly want to go right back to the Chu Lai area, which you can't get in. But they've got a. I want to just go kind of be where I was. I don't want to go to Saigon and Da Nang, and I want to go to that Chu Lai area. They built a resort there now, but I don't call it closure. I would like to go back and find the. And I don't think we can. I've looked it on maps, trying to go back to where we lost so many people on that hill, on that big mine we hit. Mm-hmm. There's just a couple certain areas I would like to. I'd just like to go stand there again and just kind of see what it felt like. And also, I would like to see some of the people I got to know a little bit. That there were Anton was the little town, or the town that was outside of the base. I got to know a few of the people that lived there. I'd like to see if they did do okay or didn't do okay once we left. But yeah, and it's a beautiful country.
Yes.
It's just an airplane ride over there. It's just murder, though. As far as how long it takes, you know, that's what I dread.
Yes. What do you think about the Vietnamese people today, both in Vietnam and then the ones that you've seen here in the United States?
Well, the ones in Vietnam, what I really like is that they're very receptive. They're happy to see us, and I know they like our money. But if anybody was going to have any hostility towards anyone, they ought to hate us. You know, I think maybe they're like us, or most of us, that they figured the politicians are the one that's got us into that thing, and they don't really hold a grudge against us, you know, soldiers that are going back. Because from all the fellas that I know, and then Dave Taylor is one of them, that when they go back, they have a great time. They're treated nice. The people are, you know, were very receptive to have us visiting. Of course, they need it. You know, they need it too, as far as their economy goes. But they seem okay. And then I met a few Vietnamese people here that are very hardworking, very honest people, and I'm glad for them. I'm glad they're doing okay, because they had a rough life over there.
Mm-hmm. What about the Vietnamese here in the United States?
Yeah, and I've met a few of them here. Seems like I keep meeting their kids, because I don't know where the parents are. But most of them that I know, very successful, well-educated, you know, a lot of them self-employed. I think they're doing fine. I'm glad they've got the opportunity to be here.
Let me ask you about the myths and the stereotypes of the Vietnam veteran. You know, you've heard this, I'm sure, many, many times. You know, that the Vietnam veteran is this kind of drugged out hippie, you know, long haired, unemployed, or you know, something like that. Can you comment on how this thing has started and your opinion about it today?
Yeah, and it's too bad, because we were treated. I wasn't, but a lot of the fellows that came back that I see now, they have a real animosity against the VFW and the American Legion. And for some of them in these smaller towns, they pretty much were unwelcome. You know, they I think a lot of them tried to come back and needed to have a group to be with just because of what they went through. And when they got to these organizations, the World War II guys, and I think some of the Korean War, I think it was mainly the World War II guys, thought, they gave us that. You guys are the, you know, the dope smoking, long-haired, scraggly looking, you know, bunch, and they didn't want any part of the Vietnam vets in their organizations.
Mm-hmm.
We had a first reunion I went to was in Reno in 1996 for the AmeriCal, and a fellow from this, from Beaverton here, actually didn't live very far from here, I didn't know it. His name was Command Sergeant Major Meade, James Meade, and he'd gone over early on. He'd been in World War II as a youngster, and then he took over, might have been the 5th or the 46th when they went over to Vietnam. But anyway, the whole banquet room was full of World War II people, and there were two tables. I think there was maybe eight seats at each table were us Vietnam vets. And he got up there, and when he started in on them, he said, look around you. He said, the reason there is none of, you know, these people, Vietnam vets, and he pointed over there at us, he says, it's because how you've treated them over the years. And he went on for about 20 minutes chewing out the World War II guys. It didn't make any friends.
Yeah.
Except for us. I mean, we were just elated. But he had pretty much made it clear that the reason these organizations out there don't have us is because how we've been treated by them for all these years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and in fact, one of the fellows I think has got that thing on tape. He's passed away since then doing that. But they never, ever acted like we were in a war. So that was a big thing. You know, we lost, they won. And then we didn't look like, you know, they should. I mean, same old thing, you know, when you've got your dad, you know, they're always getting their haircuts, you know, short butch haircuts, and the guy, you know, our hair's growing, and people are wearing mustaches and beards, and clothes look different. So
mm-hmm.
It's a generation thing, too, I think, happened there.
Yeah. Dave, if you walked into a classroom today and you were addressing high school students or college students about the war, what would you want to tell them?
Well, I did that once. I came back. In fact, when I was home on leave, I got a phone call from a social studies teacher I had in high school. His name was King, last name was King, and he asked me if I would like to come back and spend the day talking to his, I think that's the class he had, you know, and tell him really what was going to go on there at the war. So I enjoyed it. I went back and spent a day. And it was just kind of an open forum, you know, they would ask questions. Some of them were interested, some weren't, but it gave me a chance to kind of tell them what it was like. Cause, you know, I'm, you know, 2-3 weeks being back, and all I'd seen was on TV. So I did do that.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the guys I know used to partake in these things at the schools here. Up in the last few years, they would do it,
mm-hmm.
where they would visit the schools here and from all the wars and answer questions. And I think I'd probably tell them just about what I've, you know, we've talked about. Is that, you know, it was a time in our lives that when we were young and mentally could get through most anything. It might have been a wrong war, but it was something that most of us felt that we were supposed to do, right or wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I always look on the positive side. I got the best friends I could ever have, you know, from being there.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it was an experience that I wouldn't try to shut any of the memories out I have.
Now, you've done some writing. You mentioned this throughout the interview. Tell me how that started and what you've written about.
Well, I had a number of years ago, maybe 5 or 6 or probably more than that, there was a little article come up in the paper of a woman veteran was going to start a writing war stories class in a kind of a suburb of Portland here. And I'd always thought about trying to get a few things down on paper. And I went to that. Her name is Kim Cook. In fact, she's going to be speaking and having a class at the reunion. And she just had a book published here a couple months ago. I went to the publishing party.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, I thought it was important to get things down. And a lot of it for family. Not so much you're ever going to make a fortune writing a book, because we all know that didn't happen. But it's
right.
the... to get to that class. In fact, I went to, she did it for 3 years, and I went to every one. In fact, I'm kind of one of the main people, I think, in her book that she wrote, because I was there through the, from beginning to end. But she helped us get things down. Grammar didn't play any part of it. Structure wasn't any part of it. It was mainly get it down, get it in, you know, history for your families. And from then on, I realized, and I've had three, four stories published in magazines. And I think if I can ever get them together, I might put a little book together just to leave for my family. Mm-hmm. But I've enjoyed it. I write stories. Well, I write like I talk. So, I mean, if you get me on a good story, it just comes down on paper, just like I'm gonna tell somebody about what had happened. And, mm-hmm. and to me, if, I don't know if it's a healing thing or not, but it's I enjoy having them down, and sometimes I'll pick them up and read one of them and think, you know, damn, that wasn't half bad at all. You know, so I did okay. And I've never had a real writing class, and my English was terrible in high school, but I can write like I talk, so it does okay.
Okay. Tell me about your family members, your sons, your wife. How have they dealt with your Vietnam experience?
Oh, my wife's very supportive. She's 5 years younger. She remembers a couple of people, I think, in high school, maybe older brothers or things that might have gone to Vietnam. Really, I didn't really become real active in this whole thing until middle 90s. And, so it's been one of those things, but she's one of the wives that is so social and, you know, helpful that she's a big part of the reunions. We haven't missed one since 96. There's this group of the wives that kind of get together, and the wives probably hold our group together as much as the guys, just because we all get along. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's done well. You know, she goes to me to some of the dedications that we've done. My boys, I think, are proud. I've had most of them. Well, I think two of them have been to the wall with me, and that was special. And they've been up to the Vietnam Memorial that we have here, and I think they're proud of their dad. I think it's not everybody's served in a war. Not that it's glamorous, but not everybody's got a dad that actually, you know, did something like that and's got that kind of history. And you know, and I've you know, they've said, you know, even in school, I remember years ago they would say, well, they wanted to know whose dad was in Vietnam, and not all of them were. There was just a few. So,
yeah.
Yeah, and it makes me proud.
Tell me about your visits to the wall. What has that been like for you?
Well, the first one, I went with my wife, and it was special. It was the two of us. We spent quite a bit of time there. I don't remember a lot about it, but it was special. The second time is when we were there with one of the reunions in D.C., which had been about 3 or 4 years ago, and we had, I think, our biggest turnout of our, what we call our Charlie Company, 50 to 46 bunch. So I had my Bob Amos was my lieutenant. I carried the radio for that, I think, pretty much got me through over there. And Bob Franco, he was our company commander, and then plus all my buddies and friends from squad and platoon and everything. We were all there, and we all went there. And I designed our special Charlie Company hat a number of years ago, but there was probably 20, might have been 20 of us, I think, that we went as a group. And that was really special. We took some extra hats. We put them down under the fellows that we had lost over there. And we had, I think we may have five on the wall over there from that time frame that we were in there.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe more than that. I can't remember. But we took the hats there. And, in fact, the Park Service people that were there saw us. And sorry, Rich. I got to regroup a little bit.
That's fine. Do you want to stop the recording?
No, I'm fine.
Okay.
It was such a moving thing that the Park Service people blocked off both sides of the wall. Yeah, I'll be okay. Just a second.
Okay. It's fine. Take your time.
Ugh. But anyway, they made it special for us. They blocked off both sides, stopped the people, let us have our own space. They actually got some ladders out, took some pictures of us all in a group there, and it was emotional. It was another few times I've just broken down, and it was that was one of them. I tell you, standing in front of that wall with my Yeah, every now and then it happens, and it happened there at the wall. So it was special. Mm-hmm. And the only other time I think that happened that was kind of neat, I think I told you, was at the airport in Reno when the four or five of us had got together for the first time, because we had no emotions had come out, and we sat there and, bawled like babies for 20 minutes in the airport. So,
yeah.
But it was, grown men can cry, so it was. But the wall was a good time. I don't think I can ever have another one like that, because I don't think we'll get our whole group together.
Mm-hmm.
But, I think why it was so emotional, it was having the people most important to me that I served with there all together at the same time. It was really neat. And I've got my wife and kids with me too. And all the families. We were just there as one huge family, which was very special.
Some people have thought that the wall is not an appropriate memorial for you all. That it's too, it's kind of depressing. It's black granite.
Yeah.
What do you say to that?
Well, and I didn't know either. I remember with the problems that they were having when they were going to, people were complaining about it. Well, and now I think that everybody that was thought it wasn't appropriate, I think is probably changed their mind, because I think it's probably the most moving, and it says it all. It should be somber. There was nothing, nothing really happy or about it. It was it should be somber, and it should be a respectful type of a thing, and it's overwhelming to see all those names on there. It really hits you with how many of that we did lose. So I think it's fine. And I tell you, I do love the three soldiers standing there too, though.
Mm-hmm.
Those guys. I've got one of those. My wife got me a small bronze replica of the three guys I have sitting on top of my desk. I think those are great, because those, I don't know who did that. I'm sorry to say, but the way that they've got them dressed, again, that if you were a grunt, that's exactly what we look like. So I think they did a great job.
So they got it right.
Yeah, they really got it right.
Yeah,
it was. They don't have you spit and polished and things. And and to be a and I think I've said it before, but to be a grunt, that's probably the most proud thing anybody can have, is wear that CIV. And I know the fighter pilots and the helicopter pilots, they can all be proud, but to be I don't know what you call it. I always call it, we were kind of the bottom of the food chain. We were the guys that were in the middle of it, that nobody wanted to do what we did. So it's a proud thing.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of welcoming home stuff going on today in the last few years for the veterans coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq.
Yeah.
They're hailed as heroes. They're,
for sure.
They're obviously getting their due. And how do you feel as a Vietnam veteran about seeing this, 180 degree difference between how you guys were quote unquote welcomed home and what's happening now?
Yeah. Well, it doesn't bother me now, because I'm happy for them, because ran into a fella here at a local restaurant not long ago that had seen my bumper sticker and came over and shook my hand, and he had just gotten back from Iraq, and I said no, and so I ended up, I bought his lunch and stuff before we left. It was a mutual respect.
Mm-hmm.
And again, just to have somebody like that, recognize us and changing the subject a touch. But we've at some of these reunions, our group would go out on like a Thursday night as a group to a restaurant. And a lot of times we would be, very noticed. We've always got people coming up to us saying, hey, my dad was there, and we're proud of you guys. And it makes us feel good, because we're finally, people do thank us. And I've been thanked a few times over the years, in different places. But we're all still bitter about what happened to us when we came back, and I don't think it's something you're ever going to change. And I think a lot of that might have to do with the war protesters, which I don't have much feelings for. But we did our best to kind of hide because, and I never got spit on or anything like that, and we never had any problems. But it was so unpopular, and I don't know, it was just kind of unfair what we'd been through. And I think now, today, a lot of people do understand that. I know I went to a Paul Revere and a Raiders signing here in Portland a few years back, and he's a big Vietnam vet supporter, and I had a young woman come up and say thank you and for just being there. It's important, but I'm so happy that the current soldiers are getting some kind of respect when they come back.
Yeah. Do you think that's a reflection on what you guys didn't get?
Yeah, I do. I think it's quite a bit on what we didn't get. You know, I think that the people understand that it's the soldiers themselves aren't the ones that are making the decisions. You know, we're not the ones that have made this an unpopular war. And that's why both sides keep talking about, you know, we support our troops. Well, we all support our troops. So it's unlike us. You know, we were looked down upon and there was a stigma attached to us when there's not to the soldiers that are coming back now.
Yeah. Well, we're nearing the end of this interview, and I wanted to ask you, is there anything that you want to discuss or talk about that we have not touched upon?
Well, I don't think so. Yeah. I mean, something may come up, but I don't think so.
Okay. How has it been doing this oral history interview for you?
Oh, I've enjoyed it. Yeah, I think it's important. It's kind of like, for me, most things I've talked about as far as the experiences in Vietnam, I think that's all pretty clear.
Mm-hmm.
To relive some of the times, visiting the wall and just to, how important that was. But I think just to make sure that it be known there's such a common bond and a camaraderie among most of us that is special, that most people will never ever know, you know, that we have. And maybe it is because how we were treated and how unpopular the war was that, you know, we're kind of survivors from it, and we're a special bunch.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, speaking from experience of being around you all and being around a lot of Vietnam veterans,
mm-hmm.
I would absolutely agree with that.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Dave, on that note, we will go ahead and end your oral history. I want to thank you very, very much for your time.
Well, thank you, Richard. I enjoyed it.
Okay. Very good.